From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. October is here, which means the even colder days of November baseball can't be far behind. Ahead on Only a Game, a Major League Baseball postseason update. Also, the impending USOC shakeup, the impoundment of the Phoenix Coyotes in bankruptcy court, and a raging debate over one man's indefensible ranking of the 100 best sports movies. Also ahead, armed with deep three-point range, defensive lockdown skills, and an array of electrifying fast-break dunks, our own Doug Trabue attempts to crack an NBA Developmental League roster.
What's funny is I'm supposed to have beers with the ref on Wednesday. Good thing it happens after this, or else it'd be collusion. You know, I would have had all these calls going my way.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Once again last night, the Angels played like a team that has forgotten it's not supposed to beat the Red Sox in the postseason. Anaheim is up 2-0 in that series after beating Boston 4-1. The two teams meet again in Boston tomorrow afternoon. In the other American League Division Series, the Twins hung with the Yankees for 11 innings last night, but New York prevailed 4-3 on a Mark Teixeira home run to take a 2-0 lead. Those teams meet again in Minnesota tomorrow. In today's division series, the Phillies play the Rockies in Colorado. Those teams are tied at 1 game apiece following Colorado's 5-4 win on Thursday. In St. Louis, the Cardinals will try to overcome not only the 2-0 hole they're in against the Dodgers, but the miserable realization that if Matt Holliday hadn't lost sight of what appeared to be a routine line drive in the 9th inning of Thursday night's game, that series would be tied. Joining me now to discuss at least some of the above and even more is ESPN's Tim Kirkchin. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Bill.
Being down 2 in a best-of-5 series is bad enough. Knowing you came within 1 out of being even in that series is probably worse. How likely is it that the Cardinals can win today, then again tomorrow, and then again on Tuesday?
Well, no team, Bill, in the history of the division series, that's the best of five division series, has ever come back in the National League from an 0-2 deficit. If they do, it will be one of the great comebacks we've ever seen for this reason. That was as brutal a defeat as you will ever see. That game was clearly in hand. Matt Holliday would catch that line drive the next 999 times you hit it to him. And if you notice, the two guys who got the biggest hits in that game, Ronnie Belliard and Mark Loretta, two journeyman middle infielders who have no right getting the biggest hits in the game, but they did. Michael Jordan, Larry Bird always take the last shot of the game. But in baseball, the last shot, in this case, the last two shots, were taken by two relatively obscure guys to win the game. And again, that's the ultimate beauty of the game.
Tim, some fans might have expected the defending champion Phils would roll over the Rockies, at least in Philadelphia, but that series is tied. How are the two games in Colorado likely to play out?
Well, they're going to be cold. We know that, Bill. It's a very interesting situation. I'm really amazed how many people gave the Rockies no chance in this series, even though they knew that the Rockies were 30 games over 500 from the beginning of June on. They were clearly the best team in the National League from that point on. And there's something magical going on there. No team comes from as far back. I mean, they're only the 6th team ever to be 12 games under 500 and get to 20 games over 500 and make the playoffs. That's who they are. They're a very dangerous team, especially when they go home. And now they're going home. And they're going to be playing in the snow, in the cold weather, and even though they're not exactly used to that, they're certainly going to be more used to that environment than the Phillies are. So I give the Rockies every chance in the world to bring this back to Philadelphia for a game 5.
The Yankees needed extra innings to beat the Twins last night, but Alex Rodriguez seems to have realized that the season sometimes extends into mid-October. Could the Yankees get any better news than that?
No, that's the very best news that they could get. And it came, the best news came in game one for them when Alex Rodriguez did what he's done like a million times in his career. He had a line drive single to drive in a run. But it was like the entire weight of the postseason was lifted off his shoulders that he got a two-out clutch hit for the Yankees in the playoffs. Remember, Bill, his previous 16 postseason games, he'd driven in a total of one run. That one RBI in game one seemed to have just lifted everything off his shoulders, because in game two, he drove in the first three Yankee runs with, of course, a two-run homer in the ninth inning to tie the score off one of the great closers in the game, Joe Nathan. So sometimes it happens this way. You get a couple of hits finally, and you look in the mirror and you say, you know what, I can do this. It took A-Rod all this time to figure it out, but now that he has figured it out, there's all the possibility in the world that he's going to be the most dangerous hitter the rest of this postseason.
Do you think Boston's problem was that the Red Sox believed all that hype about how they always eliminate the Angels?
Well, I can't imagine that happening, and yet it's only human nature. When you've played a team 10 times and beaten them 9 out of 10 and just swept them out of the playoffs the last three times you saw them, human nature tells you, we've done this before, we can beat these guys, let's just show up and do it again. I know the media in Boston, not exactly the kindest media in the world,
aww,
pretty much assured the Red Sox, yeah, you're going to do this again. Well, it couldn't be any more wrong the way they've gone so far. Both their star pitchers have been hit, and more important, the Red Sox haven't hit anyone on the Angels staff so far. These have been two dominant pitching performances, first by John Lackey, then by Jared Weaver. And needless to say, the Red Sox are in big trouble now. Now, they have overcome 0-2 deficits more than once in their careers, but I don't like their chances in this one, not with the way those first two games went.
Tim, has anything in the early going changed your prediction that the Yankees will win the World Series this time around?
No, for once I haven't waffled. Usually I waffle like every game with the things I see. But in this case, I'm staying with the Yankees because I just think they're the overall best team. I think they proved it in the regular season. But the two keys happened in game one. We've spoken about one, that's Alex Rodriguez. The other was C.C. Sabathia pitched really well in game one for the Yankees. And he has not been a good postseason pitcher. His ERA is over 7 coming into this postseason. So those were two crucial things for the Yankees. The only two things you wondered about, how is Sabathia going to pitch and what is A-Rod going to do? Both questions were answered in game one in the affirmative, and I think more than ever, I think the Yankees are the team to beat and will win the World Series.
Tim Kirkchian, the hardest working man in sports, at least at this time of year, talks and writes about baseball for ESPN. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
After an offseason that nearly saw an NHL franchise moved from the desert to chilly Hamilton, Ontario, a bankruptcy judge will determine the fate of the Phoenix Coyotes. In the meantime, weary Phoenix hockey fans, what few there may be, will be glad to direct their strained attentions iceward. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Steve Goldstein reports.
It's a midweek evening at the Ice Den in Scottsdale, Arizona. A group of youth hockey players scrimmage while the building's occasional tenants, the Phoenix Coyotes, are in Pittsburgh, taking on the defending Stanley Cup champion Pittsburgh Penguins on opening night. A nearby television broadcasts the game, but no one pays close attention, except for one fan named Ron. He's convinced it's the next generation of fans, his son's age, who are going to make the Coyotes popular in the desert.
A lot of the kids that are playing now, that's their only team, so there's no loyalty to another team aside from the family loyalty. So yeah, the longer they stay around, the more fan base you're going to get.
Until last week, it took a lot of imagination to picture the Coyotes staying around in the Phoenix area. The organization was in bankruptcy court, up for auction, and had two bidders. One was the National Hockey League, which already has a joint control arrangement with current owner Jerry Moyes, who says he's lost more than $50 million in less than a decade in charge and filed for Chapter 11 protection. The other interested party was Canadian billionaire Jim Balsillie, whose offer of $242 million was $70 million higher than the NHL's. But if Balsillie had won the auction, he was going to back up the moving vans ASAP and take the Coyotes to Hamilton, Ontario, over the NHL's strong objections. Bankruptcy judge Redfield Baum came to the Phoenix area's rescue, sort of, and decided that neither bid made sense. So at least for the 2009-2010 season, the Coyotes will keep playing in their home arena in Glendale. Bill Daly is the NHL's deputy commissioner.
It's not good business for the National Hockey League to uproot a franchise and move it out of there if there's any chance for that team to be successful, and we think there is a chance for this team to be successful in Glendale.
The Coyotes have never won a playoff series since coming to the desert in 1996, and even the NHL's iconic Wayne Gretzky couldn't make the team popular. Of course, he was coaching, not playing. The bankruptcy process and ownership uncertainty led to Gretzky's resignation last month. Some wonder whether the NHL and the Sun Belt could ever be a winning combination. Legend has it that the late Los Angeles Kings owner Jack Kent Cook, who initially thought the hundreds of thousands of Canadian transplants in Southern California would fill seats to watch his team, lashed out when he saw home attendance plunge. He bellowed, "Now I know why they left Canada. They hate hockey." Dwayne Lewis is a Canadian who moved to Phoenix and loves hockey. He played in the minors and passionately believes the sport will be popular in Arizona. It just needs more time to become ingrained. He's seen it happen in Amarillo, Texas.
People in the South like football. It's rough. They like rodeo. Anything with the physical nature of the game seemed to be something that those hockey fans, or soon-to-be hockey fans, tied into. But hockey fans just have this passion for the sport, the rough and tumble part, the fights.
But Phoenix sports fans also like winning teams. The Arizona Cardinals used to be doormats, and their attendance reflected that. But one Super Bowl appearance has made the Redbirds the most popular team in the market. The Coyotes are off to a good start this season. They're currently 2-1-0, including their shutout of Sidney Crosby and the Penguins on Wednesday. Not too many years ago, the Penguins were a struggling club that also caught the eye of billionaire Jim Balsillie. Now they're a model franchise with exciting players and a great future. Dwayne Lewis says the Penguins' success should serve as an example for the Coyotes.
I think that's something that bodes well for them, to see those past histories of other teams, other franchises exist in tough circumstances, then come back to be success stories later on.
Travis Hare of the group Save Our Coyotes is hopeful, but at this point he's just ready for the focus to be on the hockey rather than the bankruptcy hearings.
We've just been kind of beat up throughout this whole thing too, as not supporting the team and, you know, us not being a sustainable city for the hockey, and you're just kind of waiting and hoping with everything you can that the team's going to get sold to a local bidder. But hopefully we can get right back into the hockey.
The home fans will have their first chance to cheer on the Coyotes in person tonight when the Desert Dogs host the Columbus Blue Jackets in Glendale. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix.
For the first quarter of the fifth and deciding game of the WNBA Championship Series last night, the Indiana Fever were hot. I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself. The Fever spiked to leads of 14-5 and 23-16, but Diana Taurasi's Phoenix Mercury were not to be denied in the end. Phoenix made 13 of their first 15 second-quarter shots, and though the Fever hung with the Mercury to tie the game at 80, Phoenix eventually prevailed 94-86 to win the series 3-2. Taurasi had 26 points. Mercury teammate Cappy Pondexter had 24. Tammy Sutton Brown led the Fever with 22. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Jerome Miller, former Marine and businessman, was an auto racing fan and sometime race driver as well. His family was at peace with that circumstance, and so when it was time for Jerome Miller to pull into the pits in preparation for his final lap, they agreed that the hearse carrying him should take a turn around the track at Great Lakes Dragway in Paris, Wisconsin. "Lay rubber," somebody shouted as the lap began. The hearse turned in a time of 45 seconds, quite respectable under the circumstances. The digital scoreboard lit up with the result, and a workman at the track handed the official timing slip to Jerome Miller's daughter, who is reliably reported to have smiled. All of the girls think that it's a guess. They like
your life.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we're talking movies. Sports movies, that is. We're a sports show. But first, the International Olympic Committee's decision last week to hold the 2016 Games in Rio de Janeiro certainly surprised many in Chicago who thought their city was a front runner. But the biggest effect of that decision might be in Colorado Springs, where the United States Olympic Committee is headquartered. Joining me now to chat about the state of the USOC is John Powers, who covers all things Olympics for the Boston Globe. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
On Thursday, 40 national sports bodies issued a unanimous vote of no confidence in the current leadership of the USOC, given that acting CEO Stephanie Streeter had already announced that she would step down. Was this really necessary?
Well, I think what may have happened is Stephanie may have had a heads up that that announcement was coming and may have just kind of beaten it to the punch. As a matter of fact, even now, some of the national governing bodies want her out even before a new person is chosen. I mean, this is basically has been bad blood that's been going on for a while, but no one really wanted to go public before the Chicago vote.
Chairman Larry Probst has not said that he will step down. How long do you think he keeps his job?
I don't think much longer. I mean, clearly one of the issues here was that there were a couple of major problems between the USOC and the IOC that he was involved in. One was a continued wrangle over the revenue sharing. The IOC, many of the members think the USOC gets way too much, even though the U.S. does supply most of the cash of the Olympic movement. And secondly, the USOC announced an Olympic network of their own that would compete with NBC that infuriated the IOC. So I think since this happened on Larry's watch, clearly people want him gone too.
Well, as you say, this particular wrangle has been going on for some time, but the IOC gets most of its funding from television rights, and deals with U.S. broadcasters have been worth more than all the deals involving the rest of the television networks around the world combined. Will Jacques Rogge succeed at a redistribution of funds, and what would that mean for the USOC?
Well, I think clearly, with the economy the way it is, the USOC can't afford to give up any more money than they have. But one of the problems that they have, and I think Probst kind of talked about this, was the lack of leverage that the U.S. has. They have not had a president of the IOC since Slavery Avery Brundage in the 70s. They have no one on the executive board and, basically almost no federation chiefs there. So given all of the money that they contribute, they've got very little leverage.
The early elimination of Chicago has caused some in the IOC to push for changes in the bidding process. They say that the time and the expense involved for candidate cities causes some members to cast sympathy votes in the early rounds for cities that don't really have any chance of success. How expensive is it to bid, and will the IOC really do anything to reform or change that process?
The Chicago bid cost them about $50 million in probably 4 years of time to get 18 votes. And I think some people thought there was block voting. Of course, you don't know because it's a secret ballot, but no one wanted Tokyo to be embarrassed in the first round, and they may have thrown them a few more votes than anybody thought. But I don't see this thing changing. Certainly, they won't go to an open ballot. And up until then, there's really no way to know how people voted. As a matter of fact, Atlanta once said when they lost that it took them until the third round to get what they were promised in the first round.
In previous votes, there have been, of course, charges of corruption, and some of those charges have turned out to be absolutely true. Has that been eliminated, or is that still something that's going on in this process?
Well, I think we saw this a little bit when Vancouver was clearly the best candidate for the 2010 Winter Games. And Pyeongchang, which most people couldn't even spell, much less locate, came within 3 votes of winning on the first round. And it was believed by the IOC members that Vice President Kim had actually bribed people. So I think there's certainly some influence peddling going down below. And what certainly helped Rio was that their President Lula went to a whole bunch of countries making nice. How nice? Who knows?
How diplomatically you put that. It's lovely. Meanwhile, business at the IOC marches on. Yesterday, golf and 7-a-side rugby were added to the Olympic rosters for 2016 and 2020, and Jacques Rogge was reelected to a second term as IOC president. There were, I think, a handful of abstentions and one negative vote. Any surprises on either front?
Not there. As a matter of fact, after the embarrassment last time when the IOC didn't name any sports to replace baseball and softball, they had to do 2 now. And basically what happened here is the executive board had named rugby sevens and golf as the 2 that ought to be approved. So it was pretty much a slam dunk, and if you look at the votes, they were basically landslides for both. It also didn't hurt that Jacques Rogge is a former Rugger. Rogge the Rugger.
John Powers covers Olympic matters for the Boston Globe. He joins me from time to time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Bill.
Slapshot, Bull Durham, Hoosiers, you've heard of them, right? And Rocky, of course, not to mention Rockies 2, 3, 4, and so on. But how about the bingo long traveling all-stars and Motor Kings? How about Rebound, the legend of Earl the Goat Manigault? All of the above are movies involving sports or athletes, and according to Ray Didinger, the co-author of the ultimate book of sports movies, they rank among the 100 greatest sports films of all time. Ray Didinger joins me now from WHYY in Philadelphia. Ray, welcome to Only a Game.
Nice to be here, Bill.
All right. First of all, was the purpose of this book to inspire arguments? Because I'm going to argue with these rankings, and I'm sure a lot of other moviegoers who are sports fans will, too.
Well, the arguing was certainly going to be a byproduct of the book. We knew that. Actually, the book grew out of a radio show that my co-author Glenn Macnow and I do in Philadelphia. Mostly we talk sports. It's a sports talk station. But whenever the subject of a sports movie came up, what we saw was that the phone lines just lit up and everybody wanted to call in and argue what we had said, or they have their own favorite movie, or then somebody would call up to argue with that guy's favorite movie. And after this happened, you know, many, many times, Glenn said to me, you know, I think there's a book here.
Well, tell me a little bit about the criteria by which you ranked these movies, because it's complicated. You've got movies that are meant to be taken seriously and also movies that nobody could possibly take seriously, and they're all in the same barrel. So tell me about the criteria for ranking.
Well, that was one of the problems, was how do you begin comparing The Natural to Caddyshack? You know, how do you begin trying to put in the same basket Raging Bull and Slapshot? But they were all part of the genre, and if we were going to do this book, we were going to have to sort them out in some way. Since the book's been out now for a few weeks, believe me, we have heard from a lot of people that disagree, but we knew going in that was going to be part of what the book was going to produce, so that's fine.
Well, let's get right to it then. Number 100 on your list, the worst of the best, so to speak, is The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh, except for the fact that Meadowlark Lemon, the legendary Harlem Globetrotter, appears in that film, and Eagles quarterback Donovan McNabb called the movie, quote, inspirational. What possible reason could there be for even mentioning it?
Just that we thought it was funny. We thought it was certainly different. It was very much of its time, obviously. It was made in 1979, and so the hairstyles were of that time, and the basketball short shorts were certainly of that time. You know, the fact that Julius Erving plays Moses Guthrie in it, and it's his first really extended movie role, made it kind of interesting. And you touched on one of the things that I think kind of had Glenn and I decide to put this thing in the 100. Not that either one of us loved the movie particularly, but one of the things we tried to do throughout the book was find movies that were the favorite movies of prominent athletes or coaches. And, you know, Donovan McNabb immediately said, oh, Fish That Saved Pittsburgh is my favorite movie growing up. So we decided, you know what, for that basis alone, it was worth the number 100 slot.
Were there other responses to the query for favorite sports movie that ended up surprising you?
Well, what surprised me the most was how many athletes went outside their sport for their favorite movie. For example, Cole Hamels picked Seabiscuit. Bill Parcells picked Cinderella Man. Eli Manning picked Caddyshack.
Nobody's inspired by Caddyshack, though.
Inspired probably is the wrong choice of words there. Entertained by, let's put it that way. That was a little bit surprising to us that so many athletes and coaches picked a movie outside of their sport. And in fact, I asked Cole Hamels why that was. And he said, yeah, I see all the baseball movies. I watch all the baseball movies. But when I watch them, I'm much too critical. When I'm sitting there, I'm watching it, and I'm saying, oh, he would never throw that pitch in that situation, or that's not how you grip a curveball. He said, when I watch a movie, it's about football, or in the case of Seabiscuit, about horse racing. He said, I just settle back in my chair with my bucket of popcorn, and I enjoy it like everybody else. And I had never really thought about it that way, but it kind of makes sense.
Well, let's get back to some of the specific rankings here. How the heck did you rank Caddyshack ahead of Million Dollar Baby?
People just love Caddyshack. Obviously, as a work of art, you can't begin to compare it to Million Dollar Baby. I mean, you can't. As supporting actors go, I'm not going to put Bill Murray up against Morgan Freeman. I'm not going to try and have that argument with you. But in terms of a movie that you just sit back and feel entertained, Caddyshack works, and it works forever. I mean, that's a movie that I could watch four times a year, and it would still make me laugh. One of the little categories or the subcategories we have after every film is something called repeated watching quotient.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, how many times will you watch this movie again if it comes on? I would tell you that more people would watch Caddyshack a second, third, fourth, fifth time than they would sit through the pain of Million Dollar Baby, as well as it is made. And I'll grant you that it is a wonderfully made film with some terrific performances, and it is to this day the most honored sports film of all time. It won Best Picture, it won Best Director, it won Best Actress, it won Best Supporting Actor. It walked off with more hardware than any sports film ever made. But it is a painful, tough movie to sit through. I watched it once, and I'm still not over it, to be honest with you.
Beyond that, you have bend it like Beckham at number 49. Why do you and Glenn hate soccer?
Glenn hates soccer. I don't. Glenn truly does hate soccer. That was one of the films that we kind of wrestled over. I enjoyed Bend It Like Beckham just as a wonderful study, you know, about the life of that girl and her family and fitting in, you know, whether she was a soccer player or whether she played chess. It didn't really matter to me. The whole story was kind of about a girl finding her place. I fought pretty hard to get it in the book. Believe me, Glenn was not in favor of any soccer representation at all, but I finally got him to concede the point on Bend It Like Beckham and also number 99, the film Victory with Michael Caine and Sylvester Stallone.
All right, here's a much more significant lapse in the book. You and your collaborator fail to recognize that the best sports-related movie ever made without any question is Slapshot. How did that happen?
Well, Slapshot's number six.
Six? I mean, there aren't five sports-related movies greater than Slapshot. That's just silly.
Well, listen, you're talking to two guys who really, really liked Slapshot. Now, we put Bull Durham, The Natural, Raging Bull, Hoosiers, and Rocky above it, but we really liked Slapshot. Paul Newman said it was the most profane film he's ever made, and that's certainly true by a factor of 10. But more so, I think people are shocked when they read in our book that it was written by a woman, you know, that was written by Nancy Dowd. It's tremendous. It really is. And the funny thing is the hockey community was horrified by it when it came out. I mean, they thought it was going to do terrible damage to their sport. And really, it wasn't true at all. It became very popular, and the film is still popular today. I mean, the three guys, the Hansen brothers, I mean, they still make a living being the Hansen brothers. And that film's 30 years old now, and yet these guys are still cult figures in this country.
Okay, so you agree with me that Slapshot should have been number one. To what extent have you already heard from people other than me who have been quarreling with your rankings?
Oh, many. But no one has said they didn't like it. And we've had people say, oh, you guys, of course, you're from Philly, so you're going to pick Rocky number one. Well, you know, Invincible was set in Philadelphia, too, but we made that number 62. We didn't make that number two. We think if the template of the classic sports movie is really the underdog facing his fears, overcoming his fears, overcoming the people who say you can't do it, Glenn and I both agreed that I don't think any movie ever did it better than the original Rocky. When we mention Rocky, invariably, not everyone, but there are some people that groan or roll their eyes. And what we have to say to them is, look, forget Clubber Lang, forget Ivan Drago. I mean, put all that stuff aside and just watch the original again. And tell me that it's not a terrific piece of filmmaking and storytelling. It is. You know, look, I live in Philadelphia. I live real close to the Philadelphia Art Museum. I drive by it almost every day. And every day, no matter what hour of the day or night, there are people running up the art museum steps, and there are people standing in line to get their picture taken next to the Rocky statue. That character speaks to those people. And I think in a way that almost no other sports character movie figure has ever done, or maybe ever will do.
Ray Dittinger is the co-author of The Ultimate Book of Sports Movies, featuring the 100 allegedly greatest sports films of all time. It's published by Running Press, and the co-author joined me from WHYY in Philadelphia. Ray, you've been a good sport. Thanks very much for speaking with me.
It was my pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game. Last week's program featured Ken Schulman's story about the efforts of the humanitarian organization Right to Play to enable children in a refugee camp in Lebanon to play soccer and other games. Valerie Fontana, a WBUR listener, said of that story, "It warms me. Positive efforts in our human struggle need to be heard." Ms. Fontana's enthusiasm was shared by Alden Cadwell, who hears the program on Vermont Public Radio. "I want you to know I really enjoy all of Ken Shulman's work," he wrote. "He's one of the more original reporters on the radio. I wish you featured his reports more often." Of that story, Eva Snyder wrote, "It is Lebanon's choice to keep the girls and their families in refugee camps for over 60 years. That was not mentioned in the program." The failure of Chicago to secure the 2016 Olympics provoked a long email from Ben Wilson, who lives there. "Let me get this straight," he wrote. "After the scandal at the Salt Lake Games, Congress slams the IOC. The rant heard round the world said the IOC was corrupt and called for its members to be indicted. Then we propose Chicago, infamous for its corruption, as the host city. Really? The IOC didn't vote for the country that wanted to put its members in jail? What a shocker. What's even more unbelievable is the talk in Chicago about bidding again. Perhaps it's time we take the hint. If you can call a sledgehammer to the head a hint, bid again? Holy cow!" I particularly enjoyed the Harry Carey reference in that energetic email. Regarding last week's program, a Minnesota Public Radio listener named Kirby wrote, "I thought the October 3rd show was one of your better ones, much less American football than many. I absolutely loved the segment on the poetry book. It was right up there with Elephant Polo. Thanks for a sports show that actually makes me think." And finally, speaking of thinking, Kent Buehrer, who hears Only a Game on WCBU in Illinois, emailed to ask why it is that Major League Baseball players, unlike their counterparts in pro football and basketball, don't congratulate their opponents after games. "It just reinforces the image of baseball players as overly sensitive and moody," he wrote. "I'll wait in the clubhouse for your answer." If you can help with that, get in touch with us through the website, onlyagame.org. You can also reach us at onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I've come from miles away.
The recent plowing competition at Redburn Berry Farm Hertz turned up a surprising result. Ellie Deacon, a 13-year-old girl who'd started practicing only 4 days before the competition, plowed rows that were straighter and smoother than the men who do this sort of thing for a living could manage. Ellie has qualified for next year's national plowing competition in the UK, and her father couldn't be prouder. "Ellie's a star," raved David Deacon. "It was so funny to see her beat all those grown men." "The whole thing was fantastic," said the winner herself. "It hasn't really sunk in yet, but I've been told it's because I've got the feminine touch." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, associate producer Doug Trabue is no paper lion. Can he be a paper lobster? But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Up until 2 days ago, baseball pundits were still congratulating the Cardinals on their late-season acquisition of slugger Matt Holliday. Today, oops, he's a goat. You think Holliday can recover from dropping that fly ball that hit him in the gut?
Well, to be honest with you, Bill, if you're going to be the Fred Snodgrass of the new millennium, don't get hit where Matt Holliday got hit with the fly ball. Just drop the thing. Don't add injury to insult. St. Louis is in a deep hole, and I don't think they can get out of it. And once again, Tony La Russa has reached the postseason to fall on his face.
Meanwhile, the Phillies and the Rockies meet tonight in Colorado. That series is tied 1-1. But how much of the Phillies' loss on Thursday night can be attributed to their starting pitcher being a little bit distracted?
Well, yeah, his wife, Cole Hamels' wife, Heidi, went into labor during the game after he'd finished his stint. But I think both teams are going to be more distracted by the fact that it's going to be 30 degrees and snowing.
Baseball weather.
In Denver this weekend. But it is a great story because Pedro Martinez will go to the mound to start a playoff game for the Phillies.
Before the Yankees hammered the Twins in Game 1 of their playoff series in New York, a catcher controversy, not to be confused with a quarterback controversy, developed. Are you a Jorge Posada guy or a Jose Molina guy?
I'm a Jorge Posada guy, but more to the point, I'm a not A.J. Burnett guy. Shut up and pitch. And by the way, if the Twins had managed to win Game 1 in this series, wouldn't it have been the greatest upset in baseball history?
Yes,
that team had no chance.
No sleep. Traveling right from the airport.
I suspect a spirituous flight, too.
Charlie, you and I have grown weary of Brett Favre,
yes.
But it seems that an awful lot of cable TV viewers don't feel the same way, or at least they didn't when the Vikings and Packers played on Monday.
The most watched program in cable history, the Packers and the Vikings, mm-hmm. 21.8 million viewers. That means, Bill, there are at least 21.8 million people in this country who aren't as smart as you and I are.
A conclusion to be avoided at all times when the microphones are on. Elsewhere in NFL action, will the teams playing against the St. Louis Rams soon begin anticipating that everything the Rams run will be to the right?
Rush Limbaugh and Dave Checkitz, who's the owner of the St. Louis Blues and has owned, I think, every team in every sport at one point or another, are trying to team up and buy the Rams. I would be a little bit dubious were I a sport with a largely African-American workforce hiring a guy who's kind of a chubby racist to own a team, but then again, we've had worse people owning teams in the NFL. As a matter of fact, you'll recall that the Kansas City Chiefs, when they were the Dallas Texans, were originally owned by the Hunt family, who were sort of the right-wing sugar daddies of the 60s. This would make Missouri the capital of wingnut football.
The NBA preseason has begun, and of course, exhibition games don't matter at all, but wouldn't it have been discouraging if the Cavaliers had lost the first game in which LeBron James and Shaquille O'Neal were teammates?
Yeah, but they didn't, and even LeBron James with his pink Nikes for Breast Cancer Awareness Week, he went 5-for-7, he threw a lob to Shaq, everybody cheered, and I can hardly wait for the real NBA season to start.
LeBron James, of course, jumped from high school right into the NBA. What do you make of the apparent trend that has more NBA players returning to college?
I think it's terrific. The NBA, the Players Union, has started to track this sort of thing. And, of course, this goes back to the basic principle established by Richard Lapchick when he was running the Center for Sports here in Boston, which is that the leagues or someone should pay for the continuing education of the players no matter how long it takes. Mm-hmm. And I always thought this was a terrific idea, and it seems people are starting to do it.
Argentina is in danger of missing the World Cup for the first time since 1970. The two-time champs play Peru today and Uruguay on Wednesday. Coach Diego Maradona seems to be adopting the "you can't fire me, I quit" school of negotiation amid the uproar over Argentina's poor play. At least I think that's what he was saying.
Well, we have one story here which says he's not going to leave the job and the other one that says he is, but luckily he's managed to make a lucid explanation of what's going on in his own mind. "My loyalty is to the guys," he said. "Now, here we go. Now, follow this carefully. I have everything in the computer to speak and say if I will continue under my terms or not."
Can we
read that sentence backwards, and it will make just as much sense.
I've got my fingers
crossed.
This
is the guy who used to have the drug problem.
I've got my fingers crossed that this is the result of a poor translation. I really hope so.
He may at one point have had the hand of God, but he's definitely got the brain of a moron right now.
Meanwhile, this week, Don Garber, Major League Soccer's commissioner, traveled to London to tell the heads of some of the premiership teams how to run their businesses. Are my ears ringing, or is that the high whine of irony in the room that I'm...
What do you suppose all these people did when old Don left the room? You know, by the way, we've been running a fairly successful soccer league over here, pal, for longer than you've been in sports. And by the way, go back and run your minor league, pal!
Tiger Woods said this week that he is not a billionaire, despite a report to the contrary in Forbes magazine. The folks at Forbes are usually pretty good at adding things up. So did they get this wrong, or was Tiger just getting too many calls from grammar school friends, charities, people with bridges and gold mines to sell?
Well, I'm beginning to wonder if this isn't the same thing as, you remember Bill Walton used to refuse to say he was a seven-footer because seven-footer made you freakish, but 6'11" didn't. I wonder if Tiger thinks being a billionaire makes him freakish. Nah, he probably doesn't think that.
I don't think so.
It wouldn't make me feel freakish. You'd like to give it a try to see how it would make you feel.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's like all those people in 2004 who said, "What will the Red Sox fans be like if they win one? Let's see."
Give me the billion. And finally, in an attempt to cut down on alcohol-related crime at the Bathurst 1000, Australia's most popular automobile race, patrons will be limited to 24 cans of beer per day. So no danger of overindulgence there, right,
now,
Mike?
There's one slab of beer, by the way, is 24 375 milliliter cans. I love Alan Clark, who's the assistant commissioner, who's going to enforce this probably just ungodly, unpopular crackdown. Police respect people's rights to enjoy the race weekend, but will promptly act when the law is broken. It's your 25th beer! Freeze, sucker!
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course he joins me each week here at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
23 bottles of beer on the wall. 23 bottles of beer.
Stop. The National Basketball Developmental League is expanding by two teams this season when Only a Game's Doug Tribou heard that the new minor league affiliate of the Boston Celtics was holding open tryouts last weekend. He saw his chance to, in his words, blow this taco stand on his way to the NBA.
It's Saturday morning, and the hallway outside the gymnasium at the University of Massachusetts Boston is filled with young men wearing sweatshirts and warm-up pants. They've paid $150 in advance, or $200 at the door, for the chance to show off their basketball skills for the Maine Red Claws, one of two new teams joining the NBA Development League this fall.
Go inside, make sure you get measured.
Some of the players are only a year or two out of high school, but most are between 20 and 25 years old. And there's one player who turned 35 years old 4 days before the tryout, had a forgettable high school career, still plays in a weekly pickup game, and works as a radio reporter. Yes, that's me. As we check in, I line up to have my height and wingspan measured.
All right. 6'4".
After some stretching, I move on to one of three courts to shoot around before the tryout begins. The NBA three-point lines are further out than they are in college, and the gym floor has been taped off with professional arcs. I toss up a few from downtown with mixed results.
Out in my usual territory here.
The Development League, or D-League, can be a route to the NBA for players not selected in the NBA draft. But it's still a long shot. League officials say 60% of D-League players were named to all-conference teams in college. An earlier Red Claws tryout in Charlotte drew more than 100 people. Combine that number with today's group, and you have about 170 players. The Red Claws will invite a maximum of just three open tryout players to their training camp, where the men will have to survive another cut. A handful of other players will be eligible for the D-League draft scheduled for November 5th. Red Claws general manager John Jennings says the decisions often come down to subtle skills.
I mean, there's a lot of players who can run and jump and dunk and shoot. Sometimes it's an intangible, you know, a guy that knows how to set a screen or knows how to, you know, get open.
After the shoot-around, the Red Claws team trainer leads us in some warm-up exercises. Then it's time for drills. An assistant coach puts us through full-court three-man passing and weave drills. Overall, I keep up with the pace, with one or two miscues along the way.
There we go. Sorry, man.
After the drills, head coach Austin Ainge splits us into several teams for scrimmaging.
Team six.
Six.
You ready to play?
Yeah, sure.
All right, right here under this.
Okay.
The Red Claws head coach is the son of former NBA player and current Celtics executive director of basketball operations, Danny Ainge. Austin Ainge says although all players can stay for the entire full-day tryout, nearly half of the group is quickly eliminated.
You know, immediately you can rule out some guys because they aren't big enough to play their position or aren't athletic enough to play at our level. And then you just go down, you know, whether they play hard. And then, boom, you're down to 40 guys.
We play a game with eight-minute quarters. Some of us sit out the first quarter. Then it's showtime. Most of the guys on the floor are very athletic and the pace is fast. Although I stuck to jump shots and layups, There was plenty of dunking during the shoot-around, and now there's a lot of play at and around the rim. Even when I'm able to get into a good position for a rebound, there are often three or four bodies leaping well above my reach.
There, go, there, go!
We've been given jerseys, and I'm guarding number 24, who is 6'6", with a good jump shot and enough bulk to play down low. He drives the lane, and I manage to stay between him and the basket. He goes up for a shot, and at first I have all ball. Then I have all of his face, and I'm called for a foul. I end the quarter on a positive note, grabbing my first rebound. After sitting out the next one, I'm back on the floor. Late in the fourth quarter, one of my teammates drives to the hoop and hits me with a bounce pass. I give a small head fake, a defender goes for it, and I put in an easy layup for my first and only points of the triad.
Wow.
Hartford, Connecticut resident Michael Williams is 27 and has been through this kind of tryout before. The 6'11" center played at Bryant University in Rhode Island until 2005, then played professionally for a number of European teams before a back injury forced him to stop playing full-time. He played his last professional game in 2007. Now a second-year law student, Williams keeps coming back to the game.
Unfortunately, your legs go a long time before your brain does, in most cases. So I decided, hey, it's an open tryout. It's $150. I'll come down and give it a shot, see what I got.
While there are many players from Greater Boston, there are also players from Colorado, Florida, New Jersey, Missouri, Georgia, and Canada. Williams is one of a number of men who played for professional teams abroad, and there are also several former Division I college players. At the other end of the experience spectrum is Emmanuel Ramos, a 21-year-old point guard from Lynn, Massachusetts. Ramos had a solid showing in the early scrimmages, but he has never played organized basketball. He says he realized after high school that he had to pursue his passion.
When you're young, you don't know what you want, really. But I just kept playing basketball, even if it wasn't organized, and I love it, so I'm approaching the profession.
In the past, players who failed to make the NBA could only sign on with teams in Europe or in one of the various independent leagues in the U.S. Development League president Dan Reed says the D-League was the NBA's first attempt to develop a minor league model similar to those in other sports.
It was time for a really robust minor league system in basketball the way that it had developed in baseball and hockey. Clearly, there are a lot of benefits that accrue to those sports, and the time was right to start in the NBA.
In 2001, there were 8 D-League teams. With the addition this year of the Maine Red Claws and the Springfield Armor in Western Massachusetts, there will be 16. There are 30 NBA teams, so most D-League squads have multiple affiliations. The Red Claws with the Charlotte Bobcats and the Boston Celtics, the Armor will be affiliated with the New Jersey Nets, New York Knicks, and Philadelphia 76ers. Frisco, Texas will be home to another new D-League team next season. And NBA Executive Vice President of Basketball Operations Stu Jackson says there's more expansion planned.
Our ultimate goal is to have 30 NBA D-League teams in a one-on-one affiliation with each of our NBA teams. We've already begun the process. We currently have 3 teams that own their own NBA D-League team. It's a wonderful thing to not only market, but it's very entertaining for the fans to know that they truly are seeing the future stars of the NBA.
Nearly 20% of all NBA players have spent time in the D-League. NBA teams can send down or call up first and second-year players as needed. Unlike minor league baseball and hockey, players in the D-League who don't have contracts with big league clubs can be called up by any NBA team. Most players make $30,000 or less for a season that runs from November to April. Dee Brown is the Springfield Armor's head coach. Brown played 12 seasons in the NBA for Boston, Toronto, and Orlando, and is probably best known for winning the 1991 slam dunk contest. Brown says D-League coaches need to get wins on the court while staying focused on the league's primary mission, developing players for the NBA.
My job as a coach is to put you in the best position, not just to help us win games here in Springfield, but to help you get opportunity to maybe get hooked up on an NBA team, and then the next part of that, to be able to stay up there. The best thing in my job would happen if I lost all my players to NBA teams.
Most players at the Red Claws open tryout do not get an immediate answer about their fate. but I need to know. So I check in with General Manager John Jennings.
If there was a 35-plus category, would I have made the cut today?
It's very doubtful, but and as much as I'd like to tell you that, no, honestly, the thing I loved about your game is you worked hard, and you didn't get hurt.
I loved that, too.
You heard him. He said very doubtful, but not completely doubtful. Clinging to that ray of hope, I posed the same question to head coach Austin Ainge.
No chance. I'm sorry. The athleticism isn't quite up to par with some of these guys, but if you were about 6'8", I think you'd have a chance.
Well, I have my answer, but the rest of the players will have to wait to see if they'll get another step closer to the NBA. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld. And we had help this week from John Knapp at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Doug Tribou's NBDL tryout photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Only a Game's Doug Tribou, whose tryout for the Maine Red Claws was briefly interrupted by a fire alarm.
I have a very regimented warm-up schedule. I can't have these disruptions.
Our intrepid hoopster spent the next hour sulking in his trailer. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.